Welcome to ITIF's Media Teleconference, India and the U.S. at a Crossroads, what it means for our economy, trade agenda, and beyond. All lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star 1 on your touchtone phone to ask a question. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect. And now I'd like to turn the call over to our moderator, Mr. Stephen Ezell from ITIF. Sir, you may begin.
Good afternoon. This is Stephen Ezell, the Senior Analyst for Trade Issues at the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. Thank you all for joining us today. ITIF is pleased to have three very distinguished guests with us this afternoon to discuss a growing concern to America's future competitiveness in the global marketplace. That is India and the rise of innovation mercantilism that threatens U.S. jobs and innovation. Participants include Ambassador Charlene Barshefsky, who was the United States Trade Representative from 1997 to 2001. Her decades of experience in international trade policy gives her a unique perspective on the issue of India, and we look forward to hearing her thoughts. Also with us on today's call is Mark Elliott, the Executive Vice President of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Global Intellectual Property Center, and Ed Gerwin, the Senior Fellow for Trade and Global Economic Policy at Third Way. Simply put, the United States and India are at a crossroads. While India remains one of our closest diplomatic allies, over the past several years, the Indian government has seemed intent on shutting out international competition to benefit its own domestic industries, especially those that rely on intellectual property. This is particularly troublesome for the United States, as IP and innovation are critical for our long-term economic success. In fact, IP-intensive industries account for 40% of U.S. GDP, 74% of U.S. exports, and directly or indirectly support over 40 million American jobs. This is why it's very troubling that India is again listed as a priority watch country on the U.S. Trade Representative's just-released 2 weeks ago 2013 Special 301 report, which finds that, quote, innovators are facing serious challenges in securing and enforcing patents and other intellectual property rights in India. Unfortunately, India's failure to protect foreign intellectual property rights, or IPRs, whether through unwarranted denial of IP rights or by issuing compulsory licenses, is merely emblematic of India's recent embrace of a wider range of what we at ITIF call innovation mercantilist policies. These protectionist trade practices seek to bolster Indian economic growth by distorting global trade rules and forcing investment and production to occur in India. India's government has erected such policies in a wide range of sectors, from information and communications technology, or ICT, to life sciences, clean energy, and retail. For example, India's preferential market access, or PMA, mandate could require up to 100% of governments and a substantial share of private sector ICT procurements be filled by India-based manufacturers. One of the PMA's goals is for 80% of the computers and electronics sold in India by 2020 to be manufactured domestically. In the life sciences, India has implemented a host of policies such as compulsory licensing and the denial of new or the revocation of existing patents for biopharmaceuticals. For example, just last month, the Indian Supreme Court denied Novartis a patent for a revolutionary cancer drug that had already been patented by nearly 40 other countries. And last September, India revoked Pfizer's patent for the cancer medicine Sutent, despite the fact that the Indian patent had been in effect already for 5 years prior to its revocation. While such practices may benefit India's generics industry in the short run, they will end up stifling innovation here in the United States while also actually reducing access to new life-saving medicines for India's citizens. Unfortunately, it's clear that these are not random occurrences. And when taken together, they represent a concerted industrial policy intended to restrict foreign competition and boost domestic production in India's manufacturing and IP-intensive industries. With this in mind, ITIF is authoring a new report called The Indian Economy at a Crossroads, which will examine the past, present, and future of India's economy. The report will make the case that India's robust economic growth over the past two decades largely arose from the country's decision to abandon its import substitution industrialization policies of the 1970s and 80s and instead embrace core tenets of economic liberalization and open trade. It will also argue that countries that fail to enact strong IP protection and enforcement mechanisms only damage themselves. First, weak IPRs discourage trade and investment, compromising a country's own businesses and consumers by restricting their choice and their access to best-of-breed technologies. Second, weak IPRs only stifle incentives for innovators to embark on homegrown technology development, in part because innovative enterprises are then forced to invest an undue amount of resources in protecting their ideas rather than investing in innovation. The United States has had a long and mutually beneficial relationship with India, both diplomatically and economically. But that relationship must be a two-way street, systematically shutting out American firms wishing to compete in India while simultaneously reaping the benefits of largely unfettered access to America's markets is not the behavior of a good trade partner. So what should the United States do? First, we must continue to make the case that India's use of innovation mercantilist policies is neither in its own interest nor that of the world. We must encourage India to play an attraction, not a compulsion strategy, as it seeks to bring foreign direct investment, manufacturing, and R&D activity to its country towards legitimate goals of growing its economy and its employment. And we must continue to lead by example in pursuing high-standard, innovation-promoting trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But we can't afford to wait forever. While dialogue remains important, if it continues to fail to produce a modulation in India's innovation mercantilist policies, we may need to respond with more forceful action, for the simple reality is that those policies are harming American industry and jobs today. First, Congress should direct the U.S. International Trade Commission, or ITC, to initiate an investigation of how India's mercantilist policies are damaging the U.S. economy and employment, as the ITC did with its 2011 report on China. That report found that China's innovation mercantilist policies in 1 year alone were costing the U.S. $48 billion in GDP and up to 1 million jobs. Second, Congress should begin the process now of withdrawing India's participation from the Generalized System of Preferences, which provides reduced tariffs for Indian goods entering U.S. markets. India has benefited significantly from this preference and was a top developing country GSP beneficiary in 2012, with $4.5 billion in imports entering the United States duty-free. To be clear, a strong, growing, and collaborative trade relationship between the United States and India is in both parties' best interest. But India's recent trade policies are placing that relationship in jeopardy. And if it does not modulate its policies, then it will be time for the United States to look at responding with more concerted, higher-level responses. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Ambassador Charlene Barshefsky for her thoughts. As I mentioned, Charlene served as the U.S. Trade Representative from 1997 to 2001, and she now serves as chair of the International Trade, Investment, and Market Access Practice Group with Wilma Hale. Ambassador Barshefsky.
Yeah, thanks very much, Steve, and hello to everyone on the call. I'll just make a couple of points. First of all, let me reiterate a couple of the things that Steve said. And that is that India is pursuing policies not unlike the policies that China pursues with respect to the bolstering of its domestic industries at the direct expense of foreign invested enterprises and imports into the country. In India's case, of course, the anti-innovation policies are somewhat ironic given the development of its own IT sector and India's focus on innovation-led graduate studies and so on. So there's an irony there. But the policy trends in India are unmistakable, and they really are aimed at bolstering local industries. And I'll give you just two examples. One, which Steve touched on, is the preferential market access policy with respect to the ICT sector. And here you're looking at potential local content or actual local content requirements up to 100%. You see similar forced localization of manufacturing being required in the energy sector as well as in the electronics sector, as well as, of course, in this regard, preferential market access rules for local industries. And the second general example is on the biopharmaceutical side, which really is pure Indian industrial policy, and that is to say that the Indian government is forcing foreign companies to surrender their IP to local competitors. So, as you know, there was a long fight to get India to accept the TRIPS agreement, the IP agreement in the WTO. And now what India has done basically is having given with one hand, taking away with the other. And what's interesting here is that these policies, especially in the biopharma sector, are organized with the direct involvement of Indian industry. That is to say, the compulsory licensing requirements or use of compulsory licensing that India has become extremely aggressive at has been orchestrated directly with the benefiting domestic industries. And in this regard, of course, India is now beginning to issue compulsory licenses quite outside the access to medicines context. That is quite outside the notion of highly infectious disease or healthcare emergencies. And the policy, as I said, is coordinated with the Commerce Ministry, note Commerce Ministry, and the Indian private sector as part of the commercial strategy of the Indian generic companies. This is the Indian generic companies that are behind this strategy. So, for example, India's patent controller recently issued a decision to issue a compulsory license in part on the ground that the product wasn't locally manufactured in India. And, of course, at the same time, India enjoys unfettered access to the U.S. market. India's pharma sector exports four times more than it imports. Its pharma industry exports more to the U.S. than to any other country by a wide margin. And Indian generic companies that are piggybacking on U.S. innovation in India have a large and growing market share in the U.S. And, of course, a number of controversial decisions to deny or revoke patents where the same invention is widely patented elsewhere. And Steve just alluded to Novartis's Gleevec. So the problem is acute, and it's going to become or has become serious. It will become more and more serious because this is now a matter of industrial policy for India and the development of its own industry. What are the opportunities for the Obama administration to address this? Well, the trade agenda now is as active as we've seen since the 1990s. So you have pending the TPP, you have pending the US-EU agreement, you have pending the ITA agreement, the Information Technology Agreement, and you have pending services negotiations in the WTO. And all of these agreements provide ample opportunity to address the notion of innovation, mercantilism, or what in trade parlance we would call free riding on the back of U.S. innovation as a means of strengthening domestic industry. So if you just look at TPP, with Japan now in, you're looking at about 40% of global GDP represented by the countries involved. If you look at the US-EU agreement, throw in another 20-plus percent of global GDP. So you're looking at roughly 60% of global GDP subject to, eventually, very high standards, very tough rules. And this is a perfect area for the administration to aggressively push innovation policies in the in really sort of suffuse the agreements with the notion that innovation plays a role in virtually every aspect of the American economy and many other economies, and the protection of intellectual property really is and should continue to be a core tenet. So these areas are, I think, important avenues for the Obama administration to address issues of this sort, not necessarily because the countries in TPP or in the US-EU agreement are necessarily substantial offenders, although some are, but because if you're looking at 60% of global GDP operating on very high-level standards, one could easily imagine alterations in investment flows to countries that abide by high standards, particularly in this area, particularly for innovation or IP-dependent companies. And before too long, most of the rest of GDP that's sitting out there, including India and China most especially, will begin to get the message. So I think there's quite a ways to go here, but I do think the administration is well positioned to begin to tackle some of these issues, and it needs to do that.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Barshefsky. Let me now turn it over to Mr. Mark Elliott, who is the Executive Vice President of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Global Intellectual Property Center, where he leads efforts to protect and promote global intellectual property rights. Mark?
Thank you. And just before I begin, I will apologize because I am Australian. I have an Australian accent, and occasionally I am in need of a translator, so I apologize in advance. Thank you to ITAF for bringing us together and for producing what is really an excellent report. As mentioned, I'm from the Global IP Center, so I'm going to speak specifically about intellectual property with respect to India right now. I just want to point out, which probably doesn't need to be said, that intellectual property rights, we know, are crucial to creating jobs, promoting innovation, and ensuring safety and providing access to medicines around the world. In short, intellectual property helps drive the knowledge economy, and nowhere in the world is that more important than in India right now. We believe that India is indeed at a crossroads. In 2010, the then President of India declared the next 10 years to be India's decade of innovation. Boasting one of the world's fastest growing economies, is that India would be well served by protecting the spirit of innovation, which has driven the country to outproduce developed and developing countries in an array of industries. However, as already mentioned, this rhetoric is inconsistent with recent events in India. And I'm going to give a couple of specific examples here, some of which have been mentioned, but I'm going to build on some of those. In March 2012, India issued the first ever compulsory license on Nexavar, which was a Bayer drug. Part of the reason why the Supreme Court made that decision was that it didn't meet a requirement for manufacturing domestically within India, which, of course, is not a criteria under TRIPS. Nonetheless, the compulsory license was issued under the banner of TRIPS. In October 2012, one of the world's most innovative cancer drugs on the market, which is a drug called Sutent, manufactured by Pfizer. It's for renal cell carcinoma and gastrointestinal cancer, from memory. It had a patent revoked by the Indian Patent Board. The patent is recognized in over 90 countries, and it has only been denied in India. Before Sutent, for a couple of cancer types, there was no treatment. This is one of the most genuinely innovative drugs that is on the market. In 2012, the Delhi High Court ruled in favor of an Indian generic that they did not infringe the patent rights of the Roche drug Tarceva, even though the active ingredient by its own admission was identical. Most recently, as mentioned, in April 2013, the Indian Supreme Court denied a patent on the Novartis cancer drug Gleevec, although it was recognized in over 40 countries. The argument that many of these decisions were in some way about access to medicines is completely misleading. For example, in the Gleevec case, Novartis was providing the drug free of charge to 16,000 patients in India with leukemia. That represented 95% of the entire patient population. Of the other 5% of the patients there, they were either reimbursed, insured, or participated in a very generous co-pay scheme of over 50%. Similar market access schemes were available for both for Nexavar, Sutent, and Tarceva. These decisions are clearly not related to market access. IP issues in India, of course, go well beyond the pharmaceutical space. For example, a recent study has India among the top 10 countries in the world for internet piracy. Pirated films hit the Indian streets on average within 3.1 days of release anywhere in the world. Last year, the music industry estimated a total loss of $430 million in revenue from pirated music in India. Solar industry companies have expressed concerns over possible compulsory licensing of green technologies, and the software industry continues to have serious problems in India regarding software piracy. In 2011, 63% of all software installed on India's PCs was unlicensed. The commercial value of this pirated software is worth almost $3 billion. Now, in spite of all these examples from a range of industries, we're told by the Indian government that these are all individual cases. There is no link. There is no pattern of behavior. However, the fact remains that India is the current international outlier when it comes to intellectual property protection. We are also told that many of these decisions have been made in a way that is consistent with Indian law. Whilst that may be true, it simply highlights the fact that Indian law protecting IP is woefully lacking. Last year, we produced something called the GIPC International Intellectual Property Index, which compared IP environments across the globe. The report, which was the first comprehensive cross-sectorial review of national IP regimes, it covered trademarks, patents, copyrights, international treaties and enforcement. The report, not surprisingly, placed India last, and well last, well behind China, Brazil and Russia. Whilst the specific examples I've mentioned are deeply concerning, we need to look beyond these and recognise that India's IP issues are systemic across industry and position the country as an outlier. We all know that there's a strong link between IP protection, innovation and investment. And I note on Saturday just past, the President of India asked the private sector to increase their share of spending on research and development to levels prevalent in countries such as the US, Japan and South Korea. The President went on to say, India's innovation bottom line is not very encouraging, as the number of patent applications filed annually in leading countries like US and China is roughly 12 times more than that of India. One very obvious way to encourage private sector investment in India at the same levels as the US, Japan and Korea would be to introduce an IP protection system in India that is consistent with the US, Japan and South Korea.
Mark, great. Thank you very much. Let me now turn it over to Ed Gerwin, who is the Senior Fellow for Trade and Global Economic Policy at Third Way, where he works to develop and advance pro-growth, pro-trade economic policies. Ed?
Thank you very much, Steve. Good afternoon, everyone. It is a pleasure to be here. As all of you know, the Asia-Pacific region represents a huge export opportunity for the United States. We at Third Way did a study last year in which we projected imports for the year 2020 for 12 major Asia-Pacific economies, including India. And we estimated that these 12 countries together would be importing something like $10 trillion in goods in the year 2020. That's in constant dollars, and it will be up from $4 trillion in the year 2010. Now, in recent years, the value of America's trade to the Asia-Pacific region has gone up very substantially. But America's share of that region's imports has actually plummeted, falling by over 40% between the years 2000 and 2010. If America is going to grow and to continue to create good jobs, it's absolutely critical that we grab back a bigger share of Asia's burgeoning trade. This would increase our exports by perhaps hundreds of billions of dollars and would support millions of additional good jobs for American workers. Now, in preparing for today's call, I looked specifically at our 2020 trade projections for imports into India. And I found that for 2020, we forecast that India will import almost $1 trillion in goods. Now, $1 trillion is a big number. But is it really a big number for a country as significant as India? It's interesting in this regard to compare India with China. Each country enjoys very high rates of economic growth. Each country has a rapidly expanding middle class. And each country can be a hard place to export to. And by 2020, each country will be about the same size, with a population of about 1.4 billion people. But in the year 2020, we project that China will import about $4 trillion in goods. That's a whopping four times more than India's projected imports of $1 trillion in goods. Now, of course, there are many reasons for this large gap between China's projected imports and India's projected imports, including the fact that the two countries clearly have different economic systems. But this gap is also, in our view, a significant indication of India's restrictive economy. It illustrates that India is and will continue to be significantly closed to innovative trade unless it is pressured by the United States and like-minded countries to change its restrictive trade and innovation policies. Now, these relatively low levels of projected imports for India certainly don't reflect a lack of opportunity in the Indian market. In a third-way study last year, we highlighted the tremendous opportunities for U.S. producers to sell into key markets throughout Asia. And we focused especially on sectors where the United States is highly innovative and highly competitive, in areas like infrastructure, healthcare, machinery, and food. And for India, our report included some very, very compelling examples. We found, for instance, that in the next 5 years, India will spend something like $1 trillion on 600 major infrastructure projects. We found that by 2015, India's demand for convenience foods, which is something we're very good at making, will surge by as much as 60%. We found that India will need 80,000 new hospital beds just to keep up with demand for each of the next 5 years. And we found that India's 1 billion people, only 20 million have health insurance. So there is huge opportunity for American and other foreign companies to sell into India. But India's entrenched trade barriers, unfair policies, and unfair innovation practices can make it very difficult for American exporters and investors to seize these and other significant opportunities. You've heard some very compelling examples today about these barriers from Ambassador Barshefsky and from Stephen and Mark. And there are many, many others listed in numerous USTR reports. That's why, in our view, it is critical that new trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership be pursued by the United States. And it's especially important that those deals are done right, that they provide high standards, open access, and fair rules for American trade. Now, the TPP currently already includes important economies like Malaysia and Vietnam, with Japan formally joining very soon. But the TPP and America's negotiations with Europe also have important implications for countries that go well beyond the list of current participants. For non-participating countries like India and China, these deals have the potential to underscore that high-standard trade is the new global norm. And they have the ability to increase pressure on these important economies to eventually to agree to stronger and fairer rules for trade. And ultimately, in our view, it's these stronger and fairer international rules for trade that will ensure that America's exporters and our workers get a bigger piece of a rapidly growing global pie for international trade. Stephen, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ed, and to all our panelists. At this point, I would like to open up to members of the media who are interested in asking questions of the participants. Operator, can you get us started?
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one on your touch-tone phone. You will be prompted to record your name. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted so I may introduce you to ask your question. Again, if you have a question, please press star one and record your name. One moment, please. Our first question comes from Alex Lawson, Inside U.S. Trade. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. This is, I suppose for anybody, though, I would welcome Ambassador Barshefsky's input. Many people have said, you know, the U.S. can use its active trade negotiating agenda to set a new standard for, you know, IP trade, which would send a signal to India. That strikes me, though, as kind of a long-term sort of solve. You know, that they're hoping to conclude the TPP this year, but most people think maybe that's not possible, and the EU talks haven't even started yet. I mean, what are some of the, and I keep hearing these same issues rising up and up again with India. I mean, what are some of the shorter term things we can do? I know we launched a solar case against them in the WTO and things like that, and people talk about the GSP quite a bit, but I mean, are there any more? We haven't even held a high-level dialogue with India in quite some time. I mean, what are the nearer term steps that this administration can actually do to get at the core of these complaints?
Well, I think, yeah, I'm happy to at least start the discussion on that. I agree with you. I think TPP and US-EU are a little bit longer term, particularly for the effects of those agreements and high standards to be fully felt in countries like India and China. On the other hand, it is important to recognize that for the medium and long term, setting a different level of rules and different, therefore, enforceability is extremely important. So we shouldn't lose sight of that. On the shorter term solutions, you've raised a couple. One is the absence of any real strategic dialogue on the economic side, as we have with China. India's dialogue seemed to proceed in fits and starts. One party or the other has a tendency to cancel discussions, and it sometimes takes a little bit of time for that to restart. Generally, U.S.-India relations in this regard are sometimes fraught, and that makes discussion of these issues rather difficult. Nonetheless, I do think the administration ought to reinvigorate the dialogue process with India where these issues can be raised, and not just raised, but raised at a high level. I'm talking cabinet level. So that is one element. And obviously within that context, as even outside of it, bilateral negotiations can go on. Second, I do think the administration will look at WTO-related claims, as it has done with respect to a number of countries on a wide variety of issues. And I think that's because the administration is well apprised of India's activities and is concerned about the fundamental threat to U.S. innovation and to U.S. intellectual property. Whether the administration looks at asking Congress to initiate private complaints, for example, self-initiated or congressionally initiated dumping or subsidy cases, will depend on level of imports of these kinds of products from India into the United States, but that's another possible angle for the administration. There are a number of trade remedy-related angles. There is certainly the dialogue angle. And then, of course, there is the Special 301 angle, which, as you know, the administration and most administrations have referred to as shame and name. And that's another pressure point, at the least, as well as another negotiating venue for discussion of these issues.
I would add to that that one of the other factors to some extent driving India's embrace of these innovation mercantilist policies is India's response to China's enactment of these types of policies over the last half decade. And, you know, to some extent, India's been entranced by the seemingly apparent success of China's policies. And also, when you look at the competition in certain industries, like manufacturing between China and India, India senses that it's been damaged by China's policies, so it's enacting its own. So one of the best things we could do to help India adopt the good types of innovation policies we want is by pushing back stronger and aligning global partners to push back more strongly against China's embrace of tactics like forcing IP or technology transfer as a condition of market access.
And again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press star 1 and record your name when prompted. One moment, please. I'm showing no further questions from the phone lines at this time. That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.